Welcome to Awaken, a podcast about being awake in today's world. Welcome to episode 3 of this second season, all about the Wild Seed Society. In this conversation, I chat with Aaron and Chani about the system. What is the system? How does it work? And what does it mean for those of us engaged in the work of liberation? Enjoy. We're here to talk about the current terrain of domination, specifically, what is the system?
Where do you start when you're talking about the system?
Well, it's funny, just a few minutes ago, we were talking about the oftentimes not understood ways that law enforcement, police, FBI, et cetera, fuck with social justice movements and social justice leaders and activists and organizers. You know, I was telling a friend a few days ago about how during Occupy, some of the folks who were sort of front and center at Occupy Boston were having their homes regularly like broken into and stuff just torn and thrown into disarray just cause. And we were confident that it was folks within law enforcement who were doing that. The police and police instigators and yeah.
Yeah, I mean, when we like, I think it's like very common of the left to just talk about the system as this like nebulous thing that we all are supposed to hate, which, you know, I mean, it is a nebulous thing and like we should probably dislike it because it's not really functioning to meet our human needs. But I think a really good way to like define it is to say that systems are things that we create to manage interactions between people who are outside of relationship or sometimes to codify the relationship that they're in. Right. So if I want to get something from Ravi, I can kind of just be like, hey, can I get that, you know, that tea that we had that time? Can I get some of that from your house? And then Ravi can be like, yeah, sure. You know, we don't need a system of exchange because we have a relationship. We don't have to have a bazaar or, you know, some like complicated way of figuring it out. But, you know, if Ravi and I live together and there's like 12 roommates and it's just like there's just too many relationships to manage, we might have a system to manage our like shared food because it's just like, I can't just ask you every time and have a one-on-one interaction in that way for every little thing. As societies get more complex, those systems become more and more interpersonal, right? And then it starts to be, how do you put me and Joe Blow on the street into relationships? And how do I buy food from Chipotle, right? Then you start to have systems that manage all of those interactions. And that's, I think, what a system is. And I think that sort of using the logic and the language of liberation logic and domination logic, when we talk about the system in air quotes, we're really talking mostly about state and economic systems that we're really far from, that have gotten so deep in what we would say is colonizing our life world, which is just like a fancy way of saying not only have they gotten to the place where they manage interaction between strangers, but they've gotten so deep and intermeshed with how we interact that they start to actually change the way our other relationships go, our face-to-face relationships. They change the way that we think about meeting other people. So a good example of this is like OkCupid, I think, like has really made the marketplace of relationships like metaphor, like really alive in people, that it's just about numbers. You know, it's not about meeting people of shared interest as you move through your world and people who are most likely to be connected to other things you're connected to because, you know, you're at the same place at the same time doing similar things and that's how you meet. And this idea of a marketplace of ideas is a way in which capitalism as a system and market ideas start to then change the way we do and have other relationships. And that is what I think of when I think of systems of domination, that sometimes it's like really clear in like a Foucault kind of sense of like biopower and prisons and punishment, right? Like the police giving you tickets as you drive is a way that a system sort of manages behavior on a highway or parking, right? But it also can, the system can be ways that subtly shift how we interact with each other in like the most mundane ways of like, how do I find a date for Friday night? You know, I guess it's mundane when it's my life. I'm sure other people have very exciting, vibrant dating culture when they go about that. That made me sound really old. And like, really, like I was just hearing the words come out of my mouth and I was like, man, this is like, sounds like old man podcast. It's just I haven't dated in a while. I've been in a relationship for a long time. So it just feels like a faraway thing that kids do these days.
but it feels really relevant what you're sharing, that like this concept that systems can be something that support our like our safety, the way that we interact with strangers, and making sure that there are rules in place so that we can step in knowing we know the game that's being played, or we know how to play by the rules, and that the, you know, there's at least a mutual agreement there. And acknowledging, like, I don't necessarily know that that was ever the priority with setting up these systems. Like, just being super honest, like, I think a lot of the systems that are in place, like you were saying, to dictate to us how to interact with each other and other groups in society weren't necessarily ever for our benefit primarily. And starting to talk about, yeah, I just feel really deeply that that element of control, control energy, and controlling what is appropriate, what is not appropriate, what you can say to people and what you can't say to people, how you can interact, what is okay and what's not okay in general. And yeah, that these systems aren't useful for our flourishing.
I hear that, but I think there's also a lot of complication there. Specifically, you know, I'm thinking about the ways in which, I guess I'm thinking, Aaron, a lot about what you said around how systems are created to sort of govern interpersonal interaction, but then they sort of creep their way into personal interaction. And how, you know, in the case of a violent domestic household situation, that's actually in some ways helpful, right? It's a complicated interaction, right? Like previously, domestic violence was probably overlooked, or there were, you know, there were familial systems to try to handle it that ended up putting the onus of the burden on victims. And now maybe there's more of a external system that can intervene. And are those interventions on the whole helpful or unhelpful? It's tough and it feels like multifaceted. Like I can, you know, just to name a few effects, right? Like in one sense, you can probably remove victims from abusers in a way that's more easy and streamlined, and, you know, where there's less friction in that happening. But then also, like, we maybe are like eroding our family's ability to collectively deal with hardship. We're losing certain skills that we might have had in the past, or we're leaving families potentially in like a less well-off position net. It just feels like there's a lot of different elements and angles to the system that are what make it complicated, right? If it were all bad all the time, it would be easy to say, oh, let's get rid of this thing.
To me, this is why each system can only be understood historically. Is the dishwashing system at your intentional community that feels oppressive? Is it actually oppressive? I mean, part of it is like, how did it come to be? If it came to be because some of the people in your house are privileged and work from home and have a ton of time to do things and are putting all of their sort of anxiety about the state of the world into their own space being perfect. And instead of having that conversation, they have a house meeting and say, this is the system we're going to do to clean dishes because I can't handle a dirty mess, right? Then like, yeah, maybe that's a messed up system. If it actually comes because your community comes together, has a conversation and says, oh, we know Sally is like really busy and she has, you know, the three kids. And like, we were just defaulting to having this woman of color do all the dishes. And because we're all in a relationship, like just to have an open conversation about setting the culture. And then Tim's like, oh, you know, I know this feels like not that community oriented, but a schedule would just like really help me figure out when my dishes my dish turn is. And if we could just put it on the schedule, I will always do it. You know, the system you get to in the end might be the same, but the history, the historical process from which they developed actually is the thing that determines how we interact with it. And I think the history also is embedded in the structure in a sense of whether or not the system is put over people and people's needs or not, right? And I think that's the difference between state systems and many other systems, right? We can't renegotiate the state contract. We can't renegotiate the state system. It is a thing that is seen as having interests that are more important than the individual interests of the people who govern it. Like, I think that is the problem with the thing that we call, you know, the system in quotes, right? Is that we're talking not about any system. We're talking about the kinds of systems that people put up as more important than the needs of the people that the system is supposed to serve and regulate or interact with. And, you know, maybe we want to come up with another word for it. But I think that that is a feature of a lot of dominating systems, is that the system and its integrity and its stability is more important than humans whose needs that system was supposed to solve. Yeah. So when I think when we're in a situation like we are now, we have this situation where the police, who are like, in many ways, they're the street level bureaucrat of the state. You know, they're the people you actually interact with who have a lot of autonomy and who kind of decide what the state looks like in our daily lives, particularly if you're a person of color or you're low income. The police officer is the part of the state you meet with the most. If you are, you know, upper middle class or white or in certain areas, you rarely interact with the police. And so we get into the situation where people are being killed by the street level bureaucrats of the state and then saying like, we should renegotiate this relationship. And people, a lot of white people, a lot of people with class privilege and property classes are saying that the system itself is more important than the needs of the people that are supposed to be served by that system. And part of that is because the system serves them well, right? Because that policing system is part of a larger system of extraction that allows them to have that suburban home. You know, it's the outgrowth of the militias that participated in the genocide of indigenous people and protecting of the land that was stolen. But part of that is also, I think, a deep level of authoritarianism that is bred into dominating systems, where people have attached their own sense of self-worth to their position in the system and therefore take the destabilization of that system, regardless of what that actually does for their material well-being, as a destabilization of their own internal identity. If you are good because you're an American and America is good because of the system, then the system is what makes you good. You know, and if the system of checks and balances and George Washington and all the mythos of it is what makes America great, we are great because we are good, then challenging the system not only challenges that history, but it fundamentally challenges something about who you've said you are and what makes you a good person. And I think that is at the core of where we're at as a society. My friend Annie Mahone posted, you know, this piece, she's in Michigan and talking about this white woman she was talking to who was like, you know, I really abhor Trump. Like, I think that he is against my values, but I'm really worried about the statues of George Washington being taken down and what that means for our country. And I don't see Biden really, really stepping in to like punish those people. And that I think is just so wild of what America being great because America is good, like how deeply tied to the identities of self-worth and self-actualization that is for certain fragments of the country. And I don't think it's just upper middle class white people.
I also just want to name, like, that's brilliant too, that somehow people's identities have become and sense of self-worth have become so enmeshed in the state, in that patriotism, that they're defending it like it's an extension of themselves, like it's a basic human need or something that is within themselves or within their family unit. It's like wicked brilliant. So it's like coming to my mind where I'm like, wow, that's scary.
It really blows my mind how much boils down to the protection or to the continuation of like white identity and just the profound impact of white folks not having access to a sense of healthy identity. Everything about their identity is colonized. They have nothing of their own and it just leads them to, I don't know, to have all sorts of really problematic things that they're holding on to in their experience without ever really being challenged that that's what's going on for them.
I find whiteness fascinating because it's just really unique in the history of cultures as we like understand them and read them, right? Ravi, you said they don't have anything of their own, which I just think is fascinating because it's not as if the places where folks came from have no history, right? Like Europe has a ton of culture and a ton of things. But if you look at it, you know, if you look at the lives that most white people lived in Europe, the people who came to the Western Hemisphere, they lived lives of revolt, you know, in total revolt against the state structures and kingdom structures and religious structures of Europe. And it's not, you know, it's not as if like white people just, or European history just like produced this like weird blandness, right? It's that like we created a settler colonial set of states in the Western Hemisphere that said, in order to not be a slave and to own land, you have to strip yourself of all of these communal connections that would give you an investment in anything other than this super impersonal system. So you can't have relationships. You can't have kinship networks through which you get resources, because those things would make you not like the encroachment of the state into your life. And so in order to actually be protected by this impersonal dominating state system, you have to strip yourself of all the other connections, all the other organic systems that develop to sort of support your relationships. You have to strip yourself of that. And you're given this mass-produced culture. And it's so fascinating to me because I think white people, even white people who don't think about their whiteness, like when they think about places where they have real relationship, if you ask them whether they consider those places white, I often do this in my workshops. They're like, no, though everybody there is white. You know, if you're like, where are the places where you find rich culture? And they're like, oh, I have this bird watching society. We've been doing it for so long. And then I watch the kids and, you know, and they tell all the stories. And like, that's a community. Do you think that's white? And they're like, oh. You know, and they pause because they don't associate the space with being white, because whiteness is inherently actually less about what they do as people who are white and these spaces that they're mostly in, that all the relationships and transactions and exchanging of resources is fundamentally mediated through a dominating state structures.
You were talking about how, you know, the European culture or European history has culture. And actually, I think to me, one of the things I think about a lot is just how cut off they are from any form of indigenous culture. How when Caesar wiped out Gallic culture, like that was the end. That was the end of, at least in France and England, who turned out to be the biggest colonial powers, right? Like that was basically the end of their being able to access any sort of indigenous land-based culture, anything that connected them to their roots and where they were from.
Think of how much easier it makes to control those people, right? It's like taking away all of those roots, all of those, that history, and like stripping a person of it, then they just become so much more pliable and malleable and easy to just direct, right? They're lost.
I think that's partially true. I think that's the story that those states tell about it. Like France definitely tells the story that we were barbarians, then the Romans came, and then the Franks were like, you know, civilized. Which is just like not true. It's not what actually happened. I think if you had asked somebody in Gaul, a Germanic tribe in Gaul, you know, at the fall of the Roman Empire, whether they missed the empire, some of them would have said, "What empire?" Because Rome never extended its rule into some villages. And so some of the big European cities that have the linear design were like forts in the Roman Empire, but there were tons of peasants who just like, I guess I pay taxes to this dude instead of this dude, and I have to learn how to say don't kill me in Latin. But like life really didn't change. That like the kind of systemic control that you see under industrial capitalism is just way different than what empires could do to control people before. And so I think if you look at like the French Revolution and peasant culture, peasants had communal land structures in France up until probably the 1890s, right? In Germany would have lasted longer. In Russia, literally until collectivization, they were using the same peasant communal structures until Stalin's collectivization reforms in the 30s. I think there are people who are of European descent who are alive, who have indigenous culture, but European states and American history does the same thing to that indigenous culture that we do to it in the US and Canada. We make it very small and make it seem like there aren't any indigenous people here. But as my friends, you know, who are from West Africa say, like, nah, we're indigenous to Africa, and we don't just stop becoming indigenous because we immigrate here. We have all these practices, and we don't think about that. We think of indigenous cultures are lacking technology and superstitious, and like those are the things that we think of as marks of indigeneity, and not kinship structures where like how you get adopted into a family and how your aunt systems work and the roles that your aunts play in your lives versus your uncles, the way that immigrants share money, like all of those are parts of the indigenous cultures that people come from that they take, and that no matter what capitalism tries to do, it's not very good at stripping that from people. And I think that to me is what's so fascinating about whiteness and this process in the US in the 50s of stripping that away from people until it felt like it's been hundreds of years since we had this, where their grandmothers may not have even spoken English. You know, when you know, if you go to Chicago, there is a Latvian church that's only a specific province in Latvia. Like the people who go there are all from this one province in Latvia. And then the next block, there's an Estonian church from a specific Estonian province. And then on the next block, there'll be another Estonian from a different province, you know, and it's like Southern Californians getting displaced to Brazil and going to a different church than Northern Californians. But like, you know, like there's whole neighborhoods in Chicago where people over the age of 70, like never learned to speak English and they're Polish and they're like cooking borscht and you know, doing the kind of thing that their people have been doing for hundreds of years. But we tell stories as if that's old, like those people aren't around anymore. But there's millions of them.
I'm literally shaking my head in confusion because I just don't like, my brain is having a hard time holding that, like, the white identity is manufactured. Just want to like underline that point in case anyone missed that from what Aaron was saying. Like the white identity is manufactured with multiple purposes. One of which being like easier to control people and move them into the directions you want society to go. But to your point, the fact that there is so much indigenous European culture and pockets of it scattered throughout many massive cities and communities and different ones. I know we might not have the answers, but like my brain literally goes like, how is it so prevalent then, this like white identity, when like we do still have so much indigenous culture available to us? Literally our grandma like two blocks over, who's, you know, still cooking borscht, or like, you know, our own churches. Like
I don't know if I would agree that, but I mean, Aaron, I hear you on like parts of Germany and stuff like that, where like there is some indigenous white identity, but, or, you know, Caucasian identity. But I mean, to me, the dominant story of Europe is the rise of a non-indigenous religion and sort of like, I mean, you know, I've spent some time in France actually, like, and it was a fascinating look at like culture, and like French culture is like the reproduction of Roman culture and like the pining for a Roman identity, like the architecture, the food, like, especially in Paris. I think that a dominant thread of the European Caucasian identity is like displacement from true indigenous, like land-based traditions. And I also loved what you said about how when European immigrants got to America, they, you know, they had some large shred of cultural identity that was then again sort of stripped in a remarkably quick period.
But Europe's not unique in that, right? I mean, China is basically has an entire Han identity about the people that conquered all of China in 200 AD. Like, it means like to be Han is not even the way that we think about it in the US context. It's not really a racial or ethnic identity in the way that we would say it is. It's like to be under the rule of the Han. And every culture just, you know, when the Mongols came in, they like tried to make themselves of the lineage of the Han, right? Buddhism is not indigenous to most of the places that practice it. But like, it's also like after 2000 years, like, does it become, you know, like at what point, you know, everything starts small. Islam comes from one or two cities where the prophet lived and then is now across the world. So I think there's a real question there. And if you look at Christianity that the Catholics in Paris practice is as informed by Buddhism as it is by the Roman Catholic culture, as it is by deep, you know, Frankish and German culture, as it is by like Jewish culture when, you know, all of the apostles were Jews. There is no pure culture. There is no culture without deep exchanges. And so like, what is, like, when does something stop becoming indigenous, I think is a great question. And I think my answer to that is when there's an outside force of brute colonization, but it never gets everywhere and it never gets It never gets everyone, and it never gets everything. Colonization doesn't care about making you a human being, but human beings do. And so we'll always remember some part of the practices that our parents or grandparents made to be human being. And I think there's a real question of, is it no longer indigenous? Like at what point? And I think that there's a sort of cultural ontology question of that. What a people has decided is real for them. And I think there's a place at which that gets completely replaced by a system or another culture, and you get absorbed. And what you think of as real and true and possible is the same as that dominant culture. But I guess what I'm saying, it's a spectrum and not an endpoint. And I think that whole swaths of European descendant folks are actually not that many years removed from a part of the spectrum where you could say, you could clearly identify to, this practice that you're doing is indigenous to these people who lived in this place where it made sense and worked for them. And I just think that people of European descent are much closer to that than we tell the story of, because the state is fundamentally opposed to that story being told, because it's incongruent. It's like incongruent with the system. And if the people who are supposed to be so maintained or so well maintained by that system and so ingratiated by that system can remember that there were alternatives that suited them better, then it really starts to crumble. And then you get to this idea that the white hegemony isn't natural even to white people. And that's untenable to the system. I think if white people realized how manufactured the culture was, how it was manufactured, and how easily they could adopt something else, the system starts to fall apart. Yeah, I mean, I guess I've just had tons of conversations where people like are just surprised when they interview their grandma, and then their grandma tells them all of these things that she learned from her grandparents, and just like, I don't think it's that far away for most people. But I think the interesting thing about whiteness is how few people ask.
I would agree with that. And I guess what I'm reflecting on hearing about this is hanging out with my family in Kanpur, where I was born in India. And the physical space is small, but the spiritual space between them and the Ganga River, for example, and just how accessible the Ganga is to folks as a form of identity, even in like post 500 years of colonized rule in India, versus just the time, you know, I spent some time in Paris with like basically a couple of families and got to know French culture, and like the degree to which their identity is so wrapped up in a sense of superiority in food and sort of like all of this stuff that's not land-based and accessible, like how much of their identity is tied up in things that are like inaccessible to everyone? How much superiority is a part of their identity? And that space does seem large. That space seems large. But I agree with what you're saying that like, and to sort of maybe tie everything back together to systems, as you were talking about, I think that like there's a clear opportunity in connecting folks with healthy identity that's not mediated by systems. And I guess that's what I point to when I point to the idea of like indigenous traditions, because they're also land-based. And I mean, I guess a lot of this for me is just very recent coming into the Hindu tradition as a land-based tradition, and seeing it practiced all over India in ways that are like really, really hyper local and about connecting to the land around where people are. And just how that opens up so much space for a really healthy sense of identity.
I guess I would be interested in what you think, if you see any parallels between the way that indigeneity shows up for like Hindu nationalists and the political folks. And is their religion the same as folks that it's super localized? Because that feels like a national, I mean, Hindu nationalism in the title, right? Like if you are like India as a subcontinent for Hindus, do they still have the same local connection to their spirituality?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I would say there's a very high correlation between folks who practice a very alive, local, what they would call Hindu tradition and culture, and them wanting to, I mean, like what's coming to mind to me is just like, to me right now is like smaller towns that I've visited and spent time in where there's really, really, really rich local spiritual traditions. And likely many of them are come from areas that voted for the BJP, for the current Hindu nationalist regime. Yeah, I have very little ability to make sense of how quickly, actually, no, that's not true. That's not true. The speed at which Hindu nationalism rose in India, I think is very correlated to the utter greed and corruption in the Congress Party, which I don't want to go too deep into Indian politics, but basically since independence, you know, just like from what I understand is happening in other former colonies as well, but like the Congress Party in India was the one that engineered independence and was in power for basically the past 70 years, like with little blips here and there. And the BJP, which is the current conservative nationalist, Hindu nationalist party, capitalized off of that to sell like authoritarianism wrapped up in hate of Muslims and other minorities, combined with better rule. In Kanpur, there's less power outages now than there were when the Congress Party was in power. So it's tough to draw too many conclusions, but it's complicated AF, I'll say that.
No, I mean, I like the conversation written in, undergirded by like real historical specificity. Yeah, I mean, I will also have to say, it's also like, it's so hard. It's just like, what white people are we talking about where, and like, what are our relationship with them? And like, you know, were you in like, I only have these conversations with white people in like my workshops, you know? So it's like, or racial justice workshops. So I'm like, I'm talking to a limited set. And I'm also really interested in like what are the makings of indigenousness and thinking about the removal of indigenous people from a place and moving them to like what we've derogatively called in America and been reclaimed in some ways, Indian country, right? Like Oklahoma specifically, like the number of Southern tribes that then got moved to Oklahoma, which is like a very different climate and ecology. And so a tribe that's only been there for 100 years, it seems like their indigeneity is tied to the holding of each other regardless, right? Like diasporic indigeneity and not tied to necessarily the land in all times that they've been in for 1,000 years. I think then if you ask that question, it's like, well, what about the Scots Irish in Appalachia who are definitely rooted in land and definitely have a spirituality and rootedness in a particular terrain that they've now been in for 200 to 400 years? And calling them indigenous just seems wild. To me, there's a question of like, you know, the UN definition, right? Like people who have been on a place, like within a particular state for longer than the state has been there, who have cultural, you know, who have a way of moving through culture that's different than their state, right? Like that's, I think, the technical definition of indigeneity, in which indigenous people in the US, it's like, you're still within the U.S. state and you've been moved from one part of the U.S. state to another part of the U.S. state, but you still have a culture and society that is different than the mainstream one. But I think we're also talking about indigeneity, I mean, in a spiritual sense and in a also a more ephemeral sense.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm definitely feeling my notion of indigenous, sort of just like a general equating with indigenous and good, challenged. Or good in terms of being like the question you asked specifically about the relationship between these things that I'm reflecting on fondly about folks practicing Hinduism in India and just how many of them I'm sure voted for the BJP. Yeah, it's tough to reconcile.
I think that we do this thing where we say Europeans are not indigenous, even though regardless of what happened, whatever their history, if your people have been in France for 1,000 years, you're like indigenous to France. And some indigenous culture is like kind of terrible. Like if the cultural history is to slave and colonize other people, and that is what like emerged from your culture, then I think we can say that that's like an aspect of indigenous European culture that was historically like not great for human thriving. But if you get to like peasant culture, like I'm a big fan of peasant culture, you know, of like people who are tied to the land, who are not the rulers of states but have been subjected to states, they generally, I have a lot of faith in like those places to like figure out pro-human ways to be that are better than industrial society. But a lot of those societies are patriarchal, and there are definitely peasant societies where slavery still happened. It's the gift and the curse of liberation logic thinking. You know, it doesn't have the same fuel for like righteousness to say like this is good because we're from this group and we're on the right side of history. You know, like domination shows up in a lot of different cultural places. I think you can't find a state that was not practicing domination logic. And I think state and capitalism and patriarchy are all social structures, and racism and ableism are all social structures that when systems are based on them, it just force multiplies the ability for extraction and alienation. And so I think there is a tie to a lack of alienation and a lack of domination in indigenous societies, because they at least lack in general that like state apparatus. And with most of the world under capitalism, to be indigenous also means to have a fundamentally different relationship to the economy and to how resources move. And so I think that means just like, if you're going to put your money on what society is going to be more you know, aligned with liberation logic and human flourishing at this point in history, I think it's good odds that an indigenous culture is going to be much more close to human thriving. But I do think it is fascinating to sit with some indigenous cultures developed Rome, you know, like there is a set, you know, they developed the people who went from Greece to Italy and founded Roman racial hierarchy society, right? And the Greeks, the Greeks who owned slaves were indigenous to that area. You know, it wasn't another culture that came in and like necessarily taught them slavery. Like they were indigenous to Greece, and that's a part of indigenous Greek people's history and legacy. And of course, you know, were they supported by Macedonian invasions and other cultures that came in and helped install them, as the ruling class usually is? Yes. It's fascinating. Yeah, I like that this conversation about systems really became a conversation about indigeneity organically.
Yeah, I mean, again, to try to bring it around, it's like, what do we have if we don't have systems? Like anarchy, I'll be honest, anarchy challenges me still as someone who identifies with a lot of general anarchist beliefs as well as like socialist beliefs. A lot of people will say, oh, anarchy, like how would you actually do that externally in the world? And for me, that's one question. But also, like, I think what's more interesting is, how do you actually give people the sense of internal identity that's not mediated by systems? Because that's hard.
This is the heart of it for me. I'm not against systems, and maybe we, you know, we create a different word for dominating systems, for systems that colonizing your sense of self and colonize your ontology, your philosophical belief in what is and what isn't. But I think anarchy is not about a world without systems, right? It's a world without rulers, but not a world without rules. I think that the core of anarchy is that no system is more important than the people whose needs it's supposed to serve. And that to me is the core of it. And you can get an anarchist system that is super, super complicated. You know, you can have a trillion people living in an anarchist system and massive galactic things that are still anarchist, but it means that the system is never more important than the individuals who comprise it, and that nobody has authority over another person because of their position in the system. And there's no system with agents who are able to tell you what to do because the system is more important than individuals. And that to me is the core of anarchism. And I think that once you start to deal with complexity through the anarchist lens, you have to take down hierarchy. You have to empower people, right? And so the question becomes not, is the system of organizing the tea collection in your group house, is that problematic or not? And more like, what is the rest of your life like that you don't have the ability to have a one-on-one conversation with your neighbor and your housemate about borrowing their tea? Like, what's the other system that drains so much of your energy that you had to create a system to like manage the interactions between your housemates? I think my anarchism derives from, if we don't have systems that are extractive, we actually have a lot more ability to navigate relationships in ways that get most of our needs met, that you don't need as many systems as we have because you have more energy and you have more mental capacity because you're not being drained in these other ways. But I imagine an anarchist world would still have systems. I love systems. I love managing systems. I love creating them. I love destroying them. I love tweaking them. And I'm actually not against hierarchies. I think hierarchies of worth are bad, hierarchies of authority, but natural hierarchies, you know, like Serena Williams is always going to be better at tennis than me. And there's all sorts of interesting things you can do with statistics about how good somebody is. Like, I don't think there's anything wrong with having a championship and us all saying Serena Williams is the best tennis player in the world. I think it's when we say that she's going to get $1 million for that while other people are starving. Like, that's, you know, that's a hierarchy of worth problem, not a hierarchy of talent. But I would say the idea of the myth of political leadership is fascinating to me. Cedric Robinson, the Black political thinker who sort of concretized the Black radical tradition and has, I would say, more than almost any other thinker, really infused the movement for Black lives with its analysis, wrote a book called The Terms of Order, where he talks about the myth of political leadership. And, you know, I'm writing an essay about it now, but basically it's this like Aristotelian idea, right? Aristotle believed that there's like beast, man, and God. And the only way you can live outside of the polis, outside of society in a political unit, is either you're a beast or you're a god. But to be man is to like engage in the political. And the political is like a very particular thing. And the society that allowed for men to exist is a society fundamentally based on slavery, right? It's based on this idea that there are like divergent people who have better or more mature gifts than other people, and that they have to be given the conditions to like decide what a society does, right? And so all the men are free to be part of this democracy in ancient Greece because the slaves and the women do all the work. And I think that that Aristotelian idea coming out of Greek society is like fundamental to our idea of political leadership, right? If you look at how people are describing Biden as this like moral person, and like there's this post I saw of like, you should vote for the dude who like, you know, carries his son's rosary in his pocket and calls his grandkids every day. And this is like idea that the political can be summed up by the like the extreme exemplary virtues of the leader is the basis of like the Western political mythos. And we talk so much in our political theory about these leaders and the institutions that they lead and their ability to lead institutions, in which I think a lot of it is just hogwash. Every president has decided, has like had a problem with the CIA, but none have been able to shut it down. That's not a function of political leadership, right? That's a function of U.S. global imperialism and the needs of a nation state to be able to like extract resources from the world through plausible deniability and through actions that they can say they didn't do. And so you're always going to have a CIA. And that's actually like the material basis of our political system, not the like morals of divergent leaders. And it's sort of like perpetuated from the needs of the structure itself and the way that the structure extracts resources to justify itself. And I can tell by your looks that this is like woefully abstract. So I will try and make it more concrete. I think if you look in social movements, we make everybody a hero. Everybody who does something exciting, a hero, instead of the vast majority of political actions in protests I see, is somebody who either understood the terrain of power and saw like, if I do this, other people will have this reaction. Or mostly it's people trying to meet their needs under the constraints. And then we tell a story of leadership about it. That like the bus boycott was because Rosa Parks stood up and got tired. And not because a bunch of women in the organizing committee really wanted to happen now. And the Southern Christian Leadership Conference was looking for the right person. And Rosa Parks was part of an organization of human beings having a conversation in a particular place at a particular time. And they decided collectively to do it. You know, it wasn't the moral clarity of Rosa Parks that like kicked off the bus boycotts. And it's not to say that she didn't play an important role, but she played an important role as an organizer, as a person who had relationships with other people and got them to all take collective action together.
So is your point in that kind of like, what comes up for me while I'm hearing that is that it is more useful to have a hero mythology where these like unique individuals raised in normal society, like something was unique and different about them and they made change, they stepped in, which is a really powerful narrative in that everyone kind of gravitates towards hero stories or like heroic mythology. But it also, yeah, it also perpetuates the lie that like the hero does it alone, that there's someone unique and different and special and that the majority is not like this hero, and like keeps that sort of status quo as well. I mean, that's just what's coming up for me. I'm wondering if that's kind of what you're talking about and alluding to.
I mean, I would push it even further. I don't think everybody resonates with hero stories. That's like a weird Western obsession we have with our fables, and other people's fables are not obsessed with heroes. Like, you know, I had my friend, Olga, who's Ukrainian and talks a lot about whiteness and coming here and everybody thinking she's white. And she's like, your fairy tales are weird. There's just like always a hero doing something. And our fairy tales are often like, don't like be the one who leaves your community, because the person who doesn't go with the rest of the community gets eaten by a wolf or eaten by Baba Yaga. Like, it's not a hero journey story. It's like a, you should be with the in group is like what the stories are about. Or my partner, Sandra, only watches filial piety stories where the lesson is honor your parents and good things will happen to you. You know, that's not a heroic story of like overcoming opposition. I think that's a very Western thing that's rooted in this myth of leadership. But what the myth of leadership does, I think most fundamentally, is you don't question the system. We say Obama as a good person will change it. And therefore you don't have to question whether capitalism can ever meet people's needs, because we don't have a myth of systems. We have a myth of leadership. And so we say it is the good of Obama who will deliver this good unto the people. And that actually, I think the role that it plays historically is to make people not question the system that actually determines what happens in a society. We make it about individual men who are deviant from everybody else who decide. And that actually makes you a passive agent in history. And I think that's what the myth of leadership does. And it tells a story of coherence to societies that are inherently not coherent. You know, Trump becomes elected and is not a good orator. Like, he's an emotional speaker, but he's not really good at telling coherent stories. And his inability to connect with liberal college educated elites means that the world was just thrown into incoherence for them, because he wasn't leading in a way that allowed them to tell the story of leadership and a story of America as being led by a great person, you know, and that the US has been like disintegrating in its social order since 1968, since there was this huge fracture and sort of the liberal worldview. But we've had leaders, you know, Reagan came in and restored order. And, you know, Clinton was, you know, pragmatic. And Obama was an orator and a leader. And we've told stories of coherence to like paint over a facade of a social order that's been inefficient and incapable of dealing with the contradictions of modern global society for 50 years. But we've had these like presidents who we tell these heroic stories about, so that people are shocked once the contradictions are so bare and the leader is so incapable of telling a coherent story about it, then it feels like crisis. And I think that's a lot of the role that the myth of leadership plays.
Thanks so much for listening. For more information on Wildseed and to get involved in any way, check out wildseedsociety.com. And we could always use a share, a like on whatever platform you're on. All that stuff really helps us rank on algorithms and reach more people and all that jazz. You know the drill. We've got more episodes on Wild Seed coming right up, so stay tuned. We're so, so excited to share this project with you. And again, you can check out more at wildseedsociety.com.